Welcome to the St. Martin's Challenge podcast, the podcast where we explore human nature in all its strengths and vulnerabilities, hosted by me, Lewis Owens. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to a new week. It's always lovely to start the week talking about music, and I'm delighted to have Emma Johnson on today. Described by the Times as Britain's favourite clarinetist, Emma Johnson is one of the few clarinet players to have made a career as a soloist. Since winning the BBC Young Musician of the Year at the age of 17, she has gone on to become one of the UK's biggest selling classical artists and is known for the diverse range of the repertoire she plays. She was awarded an MBE by the Queen in 1996. Emma, lovely to have you on. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a great pleasure.
It's a pleasure. I'd like to start, if I may, going back to that that day in 1984, at the tender age of 17, when you won the BBC Young Musician of the Year. A tremendous achievement, a life-changing achievement, I imagine, in many ways, certainly career-changing. Was there a sense also, Emma, that it brought additional pressure to you in some ways?
It was incredibly exciting, and after the win, I was suddenly invited to play concertos with major orchestras and to play in festivals all over the country and all over the world even. I also was invited to make recordings. So from being a schoolgirl doing my A-levels one minute, things did change overnight, of course. It's undoubtedly true that it would have been not without a lot of pressure. Any performing art involves dealing with pressure, but I seem to have, you know, just taken it in my stride.
You've coped and with it very well, obviously.
I think it was really the love of the music that just I was always, from an early age, just obsessed by music, loved it, really wanted it to be my vocation in life. So mainly I just remember the positives that here at last I was, you know, able to do what I'd always wanted to do.
Great. Well, we'll come on to your current projects in a moment, but if we can just stick, because you mentioned you were 17, you were just doing your A-levels, and it's such a pivotal time, isn't it, that age of 17. And you then went on, I believe, to read English and music at university. Now, I imagine there's always that dilemma between going to a conservatory education or going to a more standard university education. Did you apply to, I assume you applied to university before you won the award? And do you have any perhaps advice for budding musicians that are at the age of, say, 16, 17, and they're thinking, should I go down the conservatory route, or is the university route perhaps a more well-rounded education?
Yeah, you're right. My thinking was, before I won the competition, that a university education was going to be more general and make me a more rounded person. Of course, there was always the chance that music wouldn't take off for me. Yes. I mean, that's, you know, sometimes you just don't get a lucky break. And so I felt I would have more qualifications to fall back on in that case. So, but even after winning, I decided to carry on with that path. It was very, very hard work, I have to admit. So I think it's a personal decision. Yes. About whether you decide just to concentrate on music or, you know, keep your options open for longer. I think only an individual can know that on, you know, you do have to spend hours alone with your instrument if you're going to be a professional musician. So you've got to make sure that maybe the university course is the sort of course where that can be incorporated. But it's very much a personal decision, I think.
It is, and as you say, it's so competitive, isn't it, these days? I was speaking to Colin Stone last week, and he was discussing this dilemma as well, because of course his passion is music. He identifies as a musician, but he was also realistic at that age, thinking there's a lot of very, very talented, in his case, pianists out there. So he was thinking perhaps he should go down the mathematical route. We're very fortunate that both you and Colin obviously made your names in the music world, but it's very, very competitive. And particularly now, for musicians, particularly in this situation, are you sensing that the difficulties for musicians are growing as we go forward?
I am worried about musicians who are just leaving music college now or who've just started in their careers, because the pandemic has literally turned the tap off for live music making. I feel terribly lucky because I've had a 30-year career, and that's enabled me basically to build up a little bit of money in the bank account so that I can live on savings. I've made 30 recordings. I've got royalties coming in, so on. Just on a very practical level, it's really hard for these young musicians starting out now who don't have that sort of backup. And I do worry that we're going to lose a generation of musicians who just lose heart and are forced really by practical matters to do something else. I mean, I know people who are now delivery van drivers and working in supermarkets, and they were oboists or whatever, but it's just not a practical option at the moment.
Yeah, it's very concerning, isn't it? And I want to turn now, Emma, to your website, because you have a wonderful blog, which I enjoy reading, particularly the recent one, 10 Reasons to Make Music, which I loved. And I believe you were talking to your old secondary school.
That's right, largely, yes. I was invited back to Newstead Wood in Orpington. Yeah,
wonderful, wonderful. And obviously I can't go through all of them, but the one I want to pick out is the first one. And you talk about music being an emotional outlet. And you say music was a refuge during my teenage years from the stresses and anxieties of life, and still is. I think we can all relate to that. How does music help you now, Emma, aside obviously from the practical recordings? What does music mean to you personally?
I think just that, it's still somewhere, a refuge, somewhere to go that takes you away from normal life. It's an escape just for a little while that helps you to get things in perspective, so that when you come back, you just feel a bit better about yourself. Even in the pandemic, while I haven't been able to give live concerts, of course, I found myself doing a lot of composing and arranging. I thought that if I had lots of free time, I would do lots of writing and write stories and things like that. Mm. But no, it turns out when I've got a lot of free time, I just can't stop myself composing and arranging. And I seem always to need music and to be drawn to it. And I suppose also, as I'm a runner, I find it very energizing. So I listen to, all sorts of things while I'm, from Radiohead to jazz.
Oh, excellent.
Shostakovich is great if you're...
If you could run to the first movement of Shostakovich's 7th Leningrad Symphony, then you'll probably do the marathon in 2 hours 20.
But, yes, but
sorry, go on.
Well, yes, when your legs are saying to you, look, I don't want to go on, this is enough, stop, let's have the Leningrad Symphony on. And you just hear that suffering of the Russian people and how they triumphed over evil and so on. And it just keeps you going.
Absolutely. Well, I think if you mix Radiohead with Shostakovich, you've got my ideal playlist there, Emma. You really have. It's wonderful. And again, on your blog, you talk about the problems of live music today and live performances, not just for the musicians, but also for the audiences as well. It's a tremendous void for so many people that see music, as you say, as a refuge to escape, even if that's just for an hour. Just outline a couple of ways that you feel that music can perhaps still maintain that vibrancy within the pandemic.
I wrote a blog trying to suggest how we might be able to keep live music going. There are so many restrictions, but I did give a concert in early December. We kept the audience extremely spaced out. It was in a very big abbey, Romsey Abbey, but we only had 100 people in there. So each group of people was in a different row, really spread out. And if you keep the concert short, so there's no interval, the interval is the time when people might mix, yes, and I suppose then there could be transmission of the virus. I also announced all the items, so we didn't have programs that people would be handling, and people at the end were told when to leave their seat, so there wasn't a sort of pinch point at the door. So these sort of very practical measures seemed to work, although I think part of the joy of a concert is the fact that the audience can meet up in the interval and talk to each other. So it wasn't quite the same social thing as a concert usually is, but I think we got very close to it and had a very good feeling because people were so relieved and delighted, I think, just to be in the presence of live music making again. It's funny how it isn't just the musicians who make a concert, it's the audience as well. It's something very magical happens when you play music live and you sense the audience. And you sense if you've lost them or whether they're really, you know, hanging on every note. You can't really do a good performance without other people there listening. It's all part of the equation.
Absolutely. And hopefully there may be some positives in a strange way to come out of this, because I always love it when a performer comes and speaks to the audience. And sometimes I think there's a danger that people sort of heads are in the program but to actually have that engagement, I think is crucial to perhaps break down that barrier even more between the performer and the audience. So I think if more performers come out like yourself, and I know many others that do it, I think that's a wonderful development. So hopefully that could be something that could be more forthcoming in the future.
Yes, I agree. And some people have suggested that all concerts should be streamed on the internet now, but I don't really see that as a way forward. Unfortunately, it doesn't really work economically anyway, because the concert promoter has a whole lot of extra costs because they've got to stream the concert. And you tend to find the audiences at home are smaller, really, because to them, it's not a special occasion where they've had to go somewhere beautiful to listen to something. You know, they're just at home. So most people have found that economically it just doesn't work, but it's not the same thing, is it? It's more like
people like to dress up as well, don't they? People an event, it's an occasion, and people want to feel, and that's a very important part of the overall experience, I think.
Well, I always feel that because I spend a lot of my life traveling around the country playing to local music societies, and I'm very aware that they are social hubs where people, you know, meet up with friends, neighbours, or just like-minded people who live in the area. It's a very important function of music is this social aspect. So it will be a shame if we've lost a lot of that. And I have a feeling that some of the music societies, smaller festivals that were struggling before the pandemic, may not make it out of the other end of it, but my fingers are crossed, you know, that we'll be able to embrace that rich musical life again once things are more back to
normal. Let's hope so. We all need it. And tell me what you're up to now, Emma. What projects do you have on the go at the moment?
Well, as I said, I'm writing a lot of music. So I wrote, I thought, in a pandemic, what do clarinetists need? They need an unaccompanied piece. So I wrote Lament and Dance for clarinetist and tapping foot. So you have to learn how to tap your foot in the right rhythm while you're playing this. It's actually quite tricky to do. I know music teachers are always telling their pupils not to tap their foot while they're playing, but in this piece, you actually have to. So that's going to be published quite soon. And I've also been planning a Christmas recording that I'm going to be making, hopefully in May, with the Gloucester Cathedral Choir. I've been making a lot of arrangements of Christmas music for clarinet and choir. So that's another thing on the go at the moment.
Wonderful. We'll look forward to hearing those in due course and tapping our feet as well. Now, Emma, unfortunately, we're coming to the 15 minutes, but I do want to give you an opportunity to give a shout out, as I always do, to a couple of charities that may be meaningful to you.
Particularly, I'd really like to give a shout out to the Ronald McDonald House Charities. They're houses that are based near children's hospitals around the UK. And I was very fortunate to stay in one when my daughter was born prematurely and had to be in intensive care for 8 weeks. So I'm a big supporter of Ronald McDonald House Charities.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I shall make sure that they are tagged onto the podcast when I publish it. Emma Johnson, thank you ever so much for joining us. It's always painfully short, unfortunately, these sessions, but it's great to hear from you. Great to have your input about music for students and also the way ahead, hopefully. And with a bit of luck, we will not only hear you again in due course, but see you again live in due course as well. So Emma Johnson, thank you ever so much.
Thank you very much, Lewis.
Pleasure.